posted on the front door of St. Clement's Church, Leon C. Essex, England. We extend a special welcome to those who are single, married, divorced, widowed, gay, confused, filthy rich, comfortable, or dirt poor. We extend a special welcome to those who are crying newborns, skinny as a rake, or could afford to lose a few pounds. You're welcome if you are oldly, newly, notly, or just passing by. We welcome you if you can sing like Pavarotti or can't carry a note in a bucket. You're welcome here if you're just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of prison. We don't care if you're more Christian than the Archbishop of Canterbury or haven't been in church since little Jack's christening. We extend a special welcome to those who are over 60 but not grown up yet, and to teenagers who are growing up too fast. We welcome keep fit mums, football dads, starving artists, tree huggers, latte sippers, vegetarians, and junk food eaters. We welcome those who are in recovery or still addicted. We welcome you if you're having problems or you're down in the dumps, or if you don't like organized religion. We've been there too. If you blew all your money on the horses, you're welcome here. We offer a welcome to those who think the earth is flat, work too hard, don't work, can't spell, or because grandma is in town and wanted to go to church. We welcome those who are inked, pierced, or both. We offer a special welcome to those who could use a prayer right now, had religion shoved down your throat as a kid, or got lost on the London road and wound up here by mistake. We welcome tourists, seekers and doubters, bleeding hearts, and you. King David would have fit right in to St. Clement's Church in Essex. He'd been dirt poor and filthy rich. He could sing and he could sin, and he was lost and he had been found. You see, David's life was long and heartbreaking. At around 12 years old, he is identified by the prophet Samuel as the king to succeed Saul. So he leaves his family and their flocks and fields and moves to the city and to the palace. Soon, no longer a young shepherd boy, he's treated as royalty. And as a young man, he learns to fight and becomes a warrior prince. He will be the greatest military king Israel has ever seen. David reigns for a long, long time, and the people will know peace and a land of their own. But before all that, before anyone ever imagined him to be king of anything, as a child, he was taught how to be a shepherd of his father's sheep. He knew what it meant to be dirt poor. He would have worked and slept outdoors for weeks on end, moving the flock from place to place, fighting off jackals and hyenas, lions and bears. You see, the youngest sons were sent out with the sheep, while the older and stronger sons stayed home to help with the physically difficult job of sowing and plowing and harvesting. He would have worn a tunic and sandals year-round, and if it was cold, he'd wear a fleece with the wool turned to his body and a woolen scarf wrapped around his head. He'd have carried a leather bag with bread and olives, dried fruit and cheese, a rod about 3 feet long with a sharp slate at the end, a knife, a water bag, perhaps a walking staff and a sling used as a weapon. Remember, he's adept at that sling, having slain the giant Goliath. And he also perhaps would have a reed pipe to play and compose music with, because he wrote many of our psalms, which were originally performed musically. I'd like to say that David was always an honorable man, a man of faith. It is true that he conquered Jerusalem and Saul's family to rise and be anointed king. True that he slayed the giant Goliath with one stone shot from his well-used sling. True, he brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. And also true that he gathered all of the tribes of Israel together under one king. David also lusted after and had an affair with Bathsheba, the wife of one of his generals. And when she became pregnant, David called Uriah, her husband, home and tried to get Uriah to spend the night with his wife while on leave to trick him into thinking the child was his. But in honor and respect for his fellow soldiers still out there on the battlefield, Uriah didn't go home, even though David tried twice to get him into Bathsheba's bed. So to hide their sin of adultery, when Uriah goes back to the front, David tells the other generals to place him in the thickest of the fighting, thereby ensuring his death. For David's house, however, his adultery and Uriah's death is only the beginning of their stories of sin. David's oldest son, Amnon, will rape his half-sister, Tamar. And seeing that his father, David, is not going to punish Amnon, Tamar's brother, Absalom, vows to bring justice. It takes him 2 years, but he eventually gets Absalom to join him on a journey, where he orders his soldiers to kill Absalom, the heir to the throne, and they do. Amnon then flees to a neighboring country where he waits and plots and schemes against his father. Raising up allies against David, he declares war, but while fighting in the thickest of this battle, he is struck down and killed. David may have been a great warrior, a statesman, able to gather the many tribes of Israel into one nation. He may have been a man of deep faith, able to bring the Ark of the Covenant home to Jerusalem. He was also a man far off from the Lord, a man whose reign and sons would commit sin upon sin. How is it then, given such horrendous sins in the house of David, why do we sing his songs? Why do we know these stories of his family? Why do we hear in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke that Jesus is descended from this king? Joan Chittister, a Benedictine nun and author of over 24 books, writes often of personal failure and struggle. She writes that the mistake we often make is that we strive for perfection, which makes our failures that much harder to deal with. Because no matter how hard we try, we can never be perfect. The problem, says Chittister, is that we fail. We know ourselves to be weak. We stumble along being less than we can be, never living up to our own standards, let alone anyone else's. We eat too much between meals. We work too little to get ahead. We drink more than we should at the office party. We're all addicted to something. Those addictions not only cripple us, they convince us that we are worthless and incapable of being worthwhile. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy of the worst order because it traps us inside our own sense of inadequacy, of futility, of failure. Rather than seeking an unattainable perfection, says Chittister, we should appropriate the sanctifying nature of mistakes. David could have easily fallen into the trap of considering himself to be infallible because he was the king, but he didn't. Sometime after David committed adultery and had Uriah killed, the prophet Nathan came and confronted David. And David could have made excuses or ignored Nathan. We know he could have had him killed. But this great and powerful king doesn't do any of those things. His response to Nathan was simple and to the point. I have sinned against the Lord. David wants to confess, to own his mistakes, because he knows that in so doing, he will be cleansed from his sin. Seeking to be sanctified by the Lord, owning the nature of his many mistakes, David writes Psalm 51. Let me read what the notes say at the beginning of this psalm, written by this all-powerful and warrior king. To the leader, a psalm of David, when the prophet Nathan came to him after he had gone in to Bathsheba. Verse 1. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin, for I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you alone, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified in your sentence and blameless when you pass judgment. This is amazing. This is the king. He's written it and sung it in front of his people. Can you imagine a king today coming out and publicly admitting they were evil like this, deserved the worst punishment? Can we begin to understand the courage it would take to admit all of this in front of his own people? His army, his soldiers, those generals who placed Uriah in the front of the battle, his wife, his children. But David doesn't stop there. David sings of his belief in the sanctification and redemption of a God who redeems with a steadfast love. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and put a new and right spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore me to the joy of your salvation, and sustain in me a willing spirit. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth will declare your praise. Now, I don't know if it's true that, like me, you are sinners. The law of averages says that you probably are, but I don't know which ones of you are and which ones aren't. I don't know how you fit into the list of those who would be welcomed to St. Clement's Church in Leon C. Essex, England, and here, by the way, but I imagine most of us do in one way or another. The truth is, dearly beloved, we're not going to say or do the right thing all the time. None of us is perfect. We're going to mess up. We're going to fall short. But after the dark night of the soul, we can believe in the steadfast love of God, and we can get up again. Frederick Buechner suggests we do so because we are a people who have been delivered just enough to know that there's more where that came from, and whose experience of that little deliverance that has already happened inside themselves, and whose faith in the deliverance still to happen, is what sees them through the night. I don't know about you, but if God can show such steadfastness to David, if there is more grace in our world than there is sin, if, like David, we can realize our own imperfections and seek God's forgiveness anyway, and if the words of our Collect for Purity that we begin every service with on Sunday are true, then I want to walk with that God for the rest of my life. And may all God's people walk with me, and may we all say,